One of the fondest childhood memories I have is sitting there on the brown shag carpet, my parents' house. I was a young thing. I don't know how old I was. Old enough to remember. Sitting in front of a black and white television and watching Mr. Rogers. It was sometime during the morning. I don't know when exactly he was on. I don't remember that. I do remember that it made a distinct impression on me as a little kid. At first, I remember thinking it was kind of boring because there were more important or at least more interesting things on television. But he had a kind of quality that stuck with you. He became near and dear to me, Mr. Rogers did, after I became an adult, strangely enough. Not only did he represent the nostalgia of my childhood, but there were certain things that I suddenly, as a grown-up, realized he had imparted to me and to children all across a nation for 30 years, for more than 30 years, that were more important than anything I ever learned from the more interesting programs. Oh yeah, Sesame Street taught me my ABCs and how to sound out words, and that's important. But there were things that were learned in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood that were far more important. We'll talk about that during the first hour of Issues, Etc. with Pastor Bill Swirla. What can the church learn from Mr. Rogers? In the second part of this hour, Aaron Wolf joins us. He's assistant editor for Chronicles Magazine, published in Rockford, Illinois. We're going to talk about St. Augustine's City of God and the War on Terrorism. And then we'll be followed by, I guess in the second hour, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. Very interesting stuff. This state house in Washington, where two lawmakers decided to walk out during a Muslim cleric's invocation. They walked out. I heard late last week that one of the lawmakers actually apologized for having done so. And I posed the question in passing during open lines last week whether or not you would expect your elected officials in the state house or, who knows, in the House of Representatives in Washington to step off the floor if a Muslim cleric gave the invocation. I'd like to pose that question to you again and get your answer to it during open lines, and I have some other things to share with you as well. We'll round off today's program talking with Wesley Smith, senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, about a new public relations campaign by the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA. He's outraged. We'll find out why in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Pastor Bill Swirla is a regular guest here on Issues, Etc. He's pastor of Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Hacienda Heights, California, and we're going to be talking with him about what the church can learn from Mr. Rogers. Bill, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Good to be talking with you again, Todd.
What can the church learn? What did Mr. Rogers display during 30 years of broadcasting that the church might take a lesson from?
I don't know about you, Todd. I was more of a Captain Kangaroo guy myself. I was thinking about that before we went on. But it's as I got older that I appreciated Mr. Rogers for the art form that he was. And, he died a couple of weeks ago, and there was a great editorial in the L.A. Times just talking about his contribution. It really got me to think. I jotted down five, okay? The first is that it's okay to be unfashionable. There was nobody more unfashionable, I think, on television than Mr. Rogers. You know, he wore sweaters knit by his mother, I consider him kind of a heretic against the dogmas of media and communication because the scenes were set too slow. I have a friend who's in the media, and he says 10 seconds is an eternity in media, and everything went more than 10 seconds in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. His show is liturgical, same format every day. He walks in the door, changes into his, mother's hand-knit sweater. You could predict what was coming next. There was the song segment, there was the learning segment, there was the little sermon. And the amazing thing was that in spite of being so unfashionable and so irrelevant, he not only captivated children, he captivated college students. And this article in the LA Times pointed that out. I hadn't known that so much. That college students were reduced to tears at these very frank discussions from this thoroughly irrelevant man. and so it's okay to be unfashionable. You know, we try so hard to be relevant and to ape the culture, and here was a guy who just refused to.
Fred Rogers was up against Sesame Street that had just about every exciting visual and audio going for it. He was up against, well, as you mentioned, Captain Kangaroo, who tended to be a little more silly and entertaining. He was up against the Electric Company and Zoom and all of these things that kept people's minds whirring from one thing to another. How was it that the sedate, slow pace not only benefited him, but could benefit the church today?
Well, you know, I hate to say it, but I think it gave the kids a break. And I think the church might take a cue from that, too, is that we need a break from the culture. You know, I live in Los Angeles. I live in Southern California culture, and it is just continual, nonstop activity. And the media, especially the television medium, does not help here. You know, it hurts that. When the church starts to look like more on TV, it really is not encouraging people to slow down and to stop and to listen and to think and meditate and pray and receive. You know, you have to sit still to receive. And I think that there's much to be had by not going against the culture, just being decidedly unfashionable. You know, and I get down to that later, but I think that's really the thing. It set him apart from the entertainment forms of education on TV because he was simply trying to communicate with kids in a very honest and open way.
What else can the church learn from Mr. Rogers?
The second thought that I wrote down here was don't talk down to kids. It seems like we continually do that. You know, we invent kids' church, and we have kids' sermons, and we have kids' everything, you know. And we kind of communicate this thing to kids that if it's not dumbed down to their level, then it's not for them, that it has nothing whatsoever to do with them. Mr. Rogers did kind of the opposite. I think he invited the children into the adult world. You know, one of our problems is that we spend far too much time of our lives on training wheels. You know, when I learned how to ride a bike, we didn't have training wheels. Dad just sat you on the bike, and you fell off a few times. And, man, you learned how to stay on those two wheels real fast because it hurt when you fell off. But we spend, you know, we got people on training wheels. They're 25 years old. But instead, you know, he did not talk down to the kids. He talked to the kids as an adult, using kid language, but he did not act like a kid. And I think that's the key. You know, too often we go to these conferences for child educators and stuff, and they want us to act like children. You don't have to teach an adult to act like a child, but you do have to teach children to act like adults. And by treating a child as an apprenticing adult, and I think in the church as well, we've given them something they can grow into, as Henry Gehrke always says. He's another frequent guest. He talks about hymns, you know, giving them hymns they can grow into. In our preschool, they learn the creed. They don't know what all the words mean, but they learn the Apostles' Creed. They learn the Ten Commandments. They learn the Our Father. They learn parts of the liturgy. And we're apprenticing them as adults. And I think that's what Mr. Rogers did for the kids.
So is Sunday morning as well a time, in your words, to invite children into the adult world?
I think it's exactly inviting them in and welcoming them into the world of adults, of praising, communing, praying, worshiping adults. And experience here bears it out for me as a pastor. My best teenagers now are the ones who have grown up in the church. They're so comfortable by the time they're age five, you know, they're wandering around the sacristy and they're sharpening pencils at the pencil sharpener. And it's a familiarity that probably they have only at home. The only other place would be at home. And it has to do with them being there literally from before they were born.
Well, that strikes me as another connection with Fred Rogers and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Although it wasn't his actual home, we were seeing there on the set in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, for all intents and purposes, in that world of his neighborhood, that was his home.
Yep.
And it was a safe place.
Yep. And I think church ought to be that place where children learn to be at home with the holy. And there's no other way than to welcome them into that world and to invite them as apprenticing adults. See, not talk down to them.
What else can the church learn from Mr. Rogers?
The third idea that I had was he told the truth. And I think too often today we're not telling the truth to the kids, especially. He spoke very honestly, straightforwardly about what they were afraid of, their fears. And even his website, after he died, the website had a very extensive thing on there for parents of how to speak to their children about Mr. Rogers' death. You might find it interesting that death has been a taboo subject in children's books since about the 1920s. Previous century, it was all over children's books and primers and the early readers and that because death was real. If you grew up on the farm, you see death all the time. But we've sheltered children from the reality of death, and we've kind of sugarcoated their fears. And he didn't do that. He spoke directly to their fears, and I think that's why the college kids listened in tears, because they were afraid too. And so, you know, this guy in his mother's hand-knit sweaters sat there in a chair, and he talked directly to their fears, which I think the church could take a cue there.
You mentioned being honest and dealing with their fears, especially with death. I seem to remember not too long ago when he was still doing the program on a regular basis, one of the cast of characters that had been with him for years died, and they didn't replace him with someone else. They simply dealt with the fact that this person had died.
There's too much fakery going on about death in our own culture, and we insulate the children from that. Generations ago, you know, grandma died, and she was laid out on the couch, you know, in the living room, and that's where people came to pay their respects and whatnot. And now people ask, you know, should children go to the funeral home? Should we bring our children to the graveside? I'll tell you, one of the best funerals I ever had, the kids had two handfuls of dirt, and they were tossing it into grandma's grave, and they were getting their fingernails dirty, and this was a good thing. So he did that.
And what else can we learn?
Be who you are. You know, Mr. Rogers is kind of a dork. I think that's why I watched Captain Kangaroo. But he was very comfortable with that. And you know, he took a lot of flack, a lot of criticism. The comedians made fun of him. His voice was easy to impersonate. And he was the butt of a lot of jokes of some sophisticated people. But it didn't change what he did. He was very comfortable. And that came through to the children, because children have good radar for fake. And fakery never works for long with kids, or with adults for that matter. And, you know, I think as Christians, Jesus said, you know, love your neighbor as you love yourself. And you know, unless you love yourself, that sentence doesn't mean anything. And I would add that you can only love yourself as you know the love of Christ that God has showered down upon you, that you're accepted. One of Mr. Rogers' main themes was this unconditional acceptance, that you are accepted in this neighborhood the way you are. And church could learn a lesson of that too, to not only proclaim God's unconditional grace in Christ, but also to act it out, and to model that acceptance, that you are welcome as a sinner among sinners, and in Jesus' neighborhood, and it's a place where you can find acceptance.
You mentioned his popularity among college students, the Gen Xers, as they're often called. They have a pretty accurate radar for fakery as well, don't they?
Yeah, they do, and I fear sometimes that our attempts to reach out on their terms will very quickly get sniffed out as being disingenuous. It's just not authentic. And it's partly they are so exposed to all kinds of fakery in the media, in movies. They don't really trust, they don't trust authority, and they ask hard questions. And I think if we back off of that, then, and just substitute some kind of fake message, they're going to pick up on that right away. I think it's far better to be kind of a goofy guy in your mother's sweater and talk the truth, and help them through the superficial, because I don't think they're superficial people. I think they're really struggling hard, and they are afraid, and they don't know how to deal with the world. And an adult who can speak directly and clearly to their fears, especially the fear of death, I think can resonate enormously with them. You don't need a gimmick to do that.
You said that you had a list of five. Where are we, four or five?
We had number four. Number five, quickly, is extol the beautiful. You know, Paul said, whatever is true, whatever is noble, right, pure, lovely, admirable, if anything is praiseworthy, think about such things. The thing I remember about Fred Rogers' show was that he really put role models on his show. You know, he had artists and scientists and musicians, musicians who could read music and who had to tune their instruments before they played, I might add. I think Yo-Yo Ma was on the show and that. And what he didn't have is he didn't have the latest, you know, celebrity who was released on his or her own recognizance that we tend to get today. But it was extolling the good things of the culture and challenging the kids to go out and do the same, live up to that, and add to that. And I really admired that, because for the little I did watch him, I do remember just being fascinated by the people that were on there, because they were showing and doing fascinating things.
You mentioned the musicians, but he was a musician himself. He wrote probably most of the music of the songs that he also sang himself in a not very accomplished voice, but it was always music with a message. It wasn't just music for music's sake or excitement's sake.
No, there were little morality pieces or just little encouraging pieces, but they were his poetry and his music banged out on a piano. And again, there was something genuine about it. There was something it was his heart and soul in that. And I think children do have a very, very, because they do trust and they do kind of observe more carefully than we think they do. They have a good meter for what's real, and he was real. Yo-Yo Ma said that. He said it was kind of scary talking to him because he sat so close to you, and he just looked at him and says, "I'm so glad you're on my show." and he wasn't used to having somebody kind of deal with him that open-heartedly before. But I think that's how children are communicated with. I like to think that when they brought the little kids to Jesus and the big sophisticated disciples said, "You're wasting the master's time," I like to think that's what that looked like, you know?
Fred Rogers could have expanded his empire into a weekday afternoon talk show on television, an Oprah-like talk show. He could have merchandised. He didn't. He didn't. He stuck to what he was doing there in Pittsburgh. What was that about?
Well, you know, I think it has to do, you're right, he did make a number of choices. When his popularity was at its peak, I'm sure there would have been people who would love to push him beyond PBS. And I think part of it was integrity, is that he knew who he was and he knew the essence of his show. And to take that, they take that concept and do the mass marketing thing with it would have been to violate or compromise the essence. Yeah, I think it's the same way when Paul says in 2 Corinthians that we've renounced shameful and secret ways, we don't use deception, we don't distort the word of truth. He knew that it would compromise the gospel, the message of the cross of Jesus. That if he played games and if he used gimmicks and if he, you know, tried to trick people or even just seduce them into hearing, that somehow the cross would be compromised. And I think it's having a hold of what the essence of what you're doing is.
The church is being told today, Bill, that it needs to practice a little seduction with the culture. It's being told that it needs to beef up its management strategy. It needs to get rid of losing strategies and take a tip from the best of the marketeers who are out there. What would Fred Rogers, if he were the churchman speaking to the church, have to say about that?
Not sure. I mean, he was an ordained Presbyterian minister, you know. I don't think he ever served a congregation, but he, in fact, the Presbyterian Church kind of gave him permission to go and explore this. But I think that he'd probably sit down at the piano and plunk out a little simple tune in his mother's hand-knit sweater that would say something to the effect of be yourself, be who God has called you to be. You're baptized believers. And you have this great and wonderful message of reconciliation in the death of Jesus, and it doesn't need to be embellished. It just needs to be spoken sincerely and honestly, you know, face to face, to people who really do want to hear it, and not to be so worried about being relevant, being entertaining, being exciting, captivating people. That comes because you have something worth hearing.
Mr. Rogers explained everything. He explained how things were made. He had the little picture where you would go and via videotape see how a toy was made or see how candy was made. Sometimes he even left the set and did the same. And even when he was feeding his fish, which he did every day, he explained what he was doing.
I got into fish keeping that way. I still keep aquariums because of him.
Could the church do with a little more simple explanation of what's going on?
That's a great point, Todd. You know, I mean, we call it catechesis, or we used to. I don't know what we call it today, but we called it catechesis. And catechesis was much more than just making kids memorize things. And it was much more than just kind of getting certain key points of doctrine into their heads so they could repeat it or defend it. But it was also, I think, instilling a curiosity about these things. And I think we need to unpack the symbols of our church, unpack the liturgy, spend some time at the baptismal font, spend some time at the communion rail, and also in the world, and whether it's nursing homes or hospitals or whatever, and take the kids along. You know, it just occurred to me that we worry so much about recruitment for pastors. You know, great recruitment might be to, you know, take the kids along on some of these calls and watch pastors in action. You know, besides in the pulpit, but kind of see what they do and kind of go behind the scenes. That's why I like when the little kid comes to sharpen his pencils on the sacristy pencil sharpener, because it's usually while I'm putting on my chasuble and my vestments, and he talks to me. He asks me about what all that stuff's about. So we talk.
What can pastors in particular, called to lead God's people with the word and the sacraments to serve them there, what can they learn from Mr. Rogers? We've got about a minute before we got to go.
Well, you know, we're probably the least fashionable of all people in the world, I think, that we are so totally out of step. And I don't care whether you wear a collar or an open shirt or even a suit and tie. I tell you can pick out a pastor in a suit and tie as fast as anybody else. I try to hide it sometimes, and I can't. You know, they find me in the Home Depot and every place else I go. I don't know what it is. But I think it's being comfortable with being out of step and unfashionable, because God has a purpose for that. And the purpose is that we are to proclaim Jesus Christ and Him crucified to anyone and everyone that we meet, and to invite them into that neighborhood where there's holy baptism and the Lord's Supper and the forgiveness of sins. And to be comfortable with that, and not struggle so hard about blending in and fitting in and being relevant. I think people are kind of fatigued of relevance. There's too much pressure to that.
Pastor Bill Swirla, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc. Pastor Bill Swirla is pastor of Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Hacienda Heights, California. We've been answering the question, what the church can learn from Mr. Rogers. It is okay to be unfashionable. The church might do well to spend more time telling the truth, explaining things in a simple way, inviting children into the adult world and telling them the truth as well, worrying less about being relevant, with it, fashionable, hip, accommodating the culture, and simply doing the simple tasks that God has given us to do. We'll be right back to talk with Aaron Wolf.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I receive, review, and read a lot of books in preparation for the broadcast hours of Issues, Etc. Sad to say, some of what Christian publishing produces isn't worth reading, but some is. That's why we have the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month. Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February is Testing the Claims of Church Growth. You can order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. You can also order the book online. Go to our Issues, Etc. website at issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, and there you'll find a link to Concordia Publishing House. The book, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. It's the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February.
1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer in the African country of Zambia, where SIM missionary Bob Carter says malnutrition is the leading cause of death in his district.
The approach to overcome malnutrition is extremely complicated and extremely broad-based. Then, of course, HIV/AIDS, that's a big issue there. And as AIDS increases, so does the incidence of tuberculosis. And so here we need to really mobilize the church to do what the church is supposed to do.
One reason for malnutrition is that the government has encouraged farmers to grow more cash crops while abandoning the most nutritional sources of food. Carter says the ones who suffer the most are the many orphans. There are more than 9 million people in Zambia, and about one-fourth are considered evangelical Christians. Pray for missionaries in Zambia to respond wisely. Learn how to pray for needs worldwide by logging on to the internet at missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Lent is no time to leave the resurrection of Jesus Christ in the shadows, especially this Lent, when the news in the world is of war and rumors of war, when you face problems in your life that seem hopeless. This Lent is no time to put Easter off. The psalmist says, "I have set the Lord always before me," Psalm 16:8. Put him before you too, this one who conquered death. Too much happened in world history 2,000 years ago to think his resurrection is merely wishful thinking. Alive, before you. He testifies that the power of sin and evil has been broken. Whatever bad is happening in your world is but the death rattle of that doomed enemy. With resurrection, he brings a future. "I know the plans I have for you," declares the Lord, "plans to give you hope and a future," Jeremiah 29:11. "I will be with you always." Take him out of your peripheral vision and set him before your face. In John 16:33, Jesus says, "In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world." I'm Dale Meyer.
It's that time again. The Missouri Botanical Garden Spring class schedule now includes 135 classes and tours for adults and families. You can register for classes that include landscaping, specialty gardens, photography, ethnic cuisine, and cooking, plus much more. This year's schedule also includes a mother-daughter and father-son sleepover. For more information, contact the Missouri Botanical Garden.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We just finished that conversation with Pastor Bill Swirla of Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Hacienda Heights, California, talking about Fred Rogers. Well, Pastor Swirla's got a website, the congregational website for Holy Trinity out in Hacienda Heights. It's very easy to remember, but this is a place, folks, before I tell you the address, you got to go there. There are excellent articles by Pastor Swirla, and everything he writes is worth reading, from Mr. Rogers to Men's Rooms. You can read it for yourself. It is www.holytrinity.ms. That's www.holytrinity.ms. The website is newly revamped. It's got all sorts of content for you to enjoy. holytrinity.ms. During this last half hour, the first hour of Issues Etc., we're going to talk about St. Augustine's City of God. Aaron Wolf is our guest. He's assistant editor of Chronicles Magazine, published in Rockford, Illinois, and author of an article in a recent edition of Chronicles titled "Augustine's City of God." Aaron, welcome back to Issues Etc.
It's good to be here, Todd.
Aaron, tell us about Augustine and about this work of his, The City of God, and what conclusions you have drawn after looking it over again.
Well, it's interesting with all of the events that have been unfolding lately since September 11th. At all the parallels that I think I've been able to see between his time and ours, the end of the Roman civilization and now our culture today. Augustine was a bishop, a pastor in North Africa, which in the late 4th century was a province of the waning Roman Empire. And in his works, he deals with so many of the important and central theological issues that the church faces, with the Pelagian controversy, with the Donatist controversy, and in his greatest work, he deals with a group that he calls the Platoniki, a group of sort of neo-pagan syncretists that had arisen in his own day and in his town, as in part as a reaction to the attacks of the Goths on the Roman Empire.
Now, before you go on, I'd like some of that history to fill us all in, but you said Neoplatonist syncretists. Explain that term.
Well, these were pagans who had, by and large, converted, at least nominally, to Christianity over the preceding century after Constantine's conversion. But when events in history began to, when the Goths and the Persians began to close in on the Roman Empire, they abandoned Christianity and sort of went back to a type of paganism that in many respects acknowledged that the myths of the Greeks and the Romans need not be taken literally, but that they form sort of the literature of their traditional religion that they needed to pay attention to. And when they formulated this system of thinking following the writings of Plotinus and Porphyry, they also sort of mixed a little Christianity in as well. And what they really despised was the claim of the Christians, of the Catholics at the time, the church that maintained Nicene Orthodoxy. They despised their claim that Christ was the only God and central to one's belief, and that you had to trust in him alone for salvation.
I'm beginning to see the parallels to our present day. Now, you mentioned the Goths breathing and the Persians breathing down the neck of the Roman Empire. We are, at this point in history, Augustine is witnessing basically the collapse of the Roman Empire, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, he is. The Alaric, who had been allowed to hold military positions sort of as a mercenary in the Roman Empire, had worked his way south. He had stayed near Milan for a while, where Augustine had studied under St. Ambrose, and then he finally just moved in to the city of Rome and burned a great deal of it, though he and his men did spare some of the churches.
So where do you see the parallel in that regard to our situation today, perhaps especially in American Christianity?
Well, the church in America today is interesting how so many Christians are connected to this idea of American exceptionalism in the world, that we have some sort of divine mission to spread freedom or democracy, or as President Clinton used to say, our values around the world, and oftentimes, in fact, we even project that into our foreign policy and go to war with the idea that we're spreading democracy and liberating others. And I think at the base there's a theological concept there of that has been with the United States before its founding, this idea that the Puritans brought over, that America is destined to be a shining city on a hill and so on. And I think many of the Romans at that time, even those that were converted to Christianity, had that same idea of Rome, and that, in a way, the spread of Rome was like the spread of the kingdom of God. Excuse me. And so when Rome burned at the hands of this barbarian, they were completely taken aback and puzzled as to how God could allow his chosen nation to be attacked thus.
Do you draw a parallel there, perhaps, with September 11th?
Absolutely, I do. And this the idea that so many Americans were shocked that America could be attacked, that the response by so many was draped in that type of religious, theological, even apocalyptic language. And of course, even President Bush in his speech talking about the United States embarking on a war against evil in response to September 11th seems to me to parallel that situation.
You mentioned this American exceptionalism, or that somehow America enjoys most favored nation status with God and has and will. It always amazes me when we hear politicians, even those of the stature of Lincoln, talking about the American way of life, our values, our system, never perishing from the earth. It seems a pretty big ticket to fill to never perish from the earth, a civilization that does not die. This is something, Aaron, that is built into the American mindset. We're raised with this, aren't we?
Absolutely. And many of our wars over the last century, at least, have been fought with that justification in mind. And it's interesting that even with the sort of waning of post-millennial thought, this idea that America is the harbinger of the kingdom of God on earth, and the rise of dispensationalism, that we seem to have come full circle even now, and so that American evangelicals, who in the past perhaps would have rejected this idea and stayed out of politics, have now come to see the United States as having this role once again, only more so in their defense of the nation of Israel.
The post-millennial, the premillennial dispensational views that America not only has a role in biblical prophecy, but a key role to play in the unfolding of end times events. That's what you're talking about.
Yes.
In particular.
Yes, and the leaders, many of the Republican leadership, those of the public Republican leadership who don't think that way, who sort of come from the more liberal tradition of the mainlines, that embrace kind of a more and more secularized version of that manifest destiny, post-millennial vision of the Puritans, those folks know how to push the buttons so often of the evangelicals and speak the same language, talking about America's need to protect Israel, and they get votes that way, just like when they talk about returning to the family values of the past. But I think they're coming at it from a completely different perspective.
Now, you have suggested that while we should not pursue the path that premillennial dispensationalism and other end times theologies lead to, kind of this America as God's favored nation along with Israel, you have suggested that it is time for the church, in particular the city of God, as Augustine would have put it, to think apocalyptically, to think eschatologically. How so?
Yes, and this is the genius, I think, of City of God and why it's essential reading for today, because that was Augustine's argument. These folks that were fleeing the burning city of Rome and coming to live in their summer homes in North Africa were infecting the people in Augustine's parish with some of these ideas that I mentioned before. And his response to them was twofold. One, to completely attack and destroy their paganism apologetically, to walk through the kind of neo-pagan historicism that the Romans were so prone to, where they saw themselves as having been protected by the gods over and over again throughout their history. And by attacking that and talking about how the scripture instead paints a picture of God giving power to whom he will, to the nations of the earth, and then taking it away whenever he pleases, and that we cannot even begin to understand why he would favor one nation or another with power, that we simply have to instead turn our focus to the eternal city of God, the kingdom of Christ, which is already inaugurated, Christ having sat down on his throne and reigning from heaven, and that Christians need to take their eyes off of politics, at least when it comes to where their hope lies, and instead focus it on this completely different realm, which the scripture sort of lifts the veil that stands between us and this otherworldly realm, where Christ reigns and where the gospel is central, and where the battle is not between one army and another, but for the souls of men and women against the devil and against the world and the flesh.
We're talking with Aaron Wolf, assistant editor for Chronicles Magazine, published in Rockford, Illinois, about St. Augustine and his City of God. He's author of an article in a recent edition of Chronicles titled Augustine's City of God. If you'd like to join us, you may do so. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You've also pointed out, Aaron, that Christians spend a lot of time being news junkies as opposed to what you suggest might be a better way to spend their time.
Well, and I'm afraid I fall prey to that too, and part of it is working for as a journalist and trying to respond to the news every day. But that I think that it is a problem for Christians, even those that aren't evangelical dispensationalists, even those in the Lutheran Church that are my friends, tend to invest a lot of emotional capital in America, not so much as a citizen, but just in terms of our place in the world and our need to liberate other nations around the world. And it's the same sort of logic that Augustine attacks in his City of God, where he calls us to lift our eyes up and away from this quagmire on the earth. And because in fact, if we do focus on that, then our hopes are dashed, because so often power will change hands, and someone that's evil will come into power, or our nation might suffer persecution, and we cannot put our hope and our trust in politics.
Is America like Rome, not only in the historical parallel with Augustine's age, but in the broader sweep of history, like Rome, like all other empires that have risen and fallen? Is America, in one sense or another, sooner or later destined to fall?
Absolutely. And this is I tell you, one of the greatest books that I've been able to get my hands on lately, or in the last few years, is Professor Brighton's commentary on Revelation. And as I've read that over and looked, the image over and over again that we have is one of God allowing the nations of the world to go out and conquer and make war, but yet at the same time the church is painted as outside of that and separate from that, and looking to Christ and longing to be in His kingdom and praying, "Thy kingdom come," and so on. But the message of Scripture, and I think particularly that Dr. Brighton points out so clearly, is that every empire is destined to fall. Every human government cannot last, because ultimately every human government has to some extent an opposition to Christ and His kingdom.
Now, someone might have been reading between the lines here in our conversation and drawn the conclusion that you, Aaron, do not believe that there should be, drawing the parallels with Augustine's times, that there should be no war on terrorism, period. We should just simply sit back and let history take its course.
Well, you know, this is where I think the Augustine's model of the City of God versus the City of Man, and the way Luther so beautifully picks that up in his Two Kingdoms theology, really comes into play, because we see that there really is a city of man, a place where the law reigns supreme, and where there's human government, and this place is necessary too, and we have laws and we have politicians and princes that to some extent we have to recognize God has put into place. So that's the message of Scripture. And that's the message of our tradition in the Lutheran Church, that what we need to do is not be anarchists and not look at human government as if it's something to be completely despised. In fact, Luther teaches quite the opposite, but rather that we need to keep the two realms separate and keep our focus when it comes to politics on practical matters, on wise foreign policy, and even learn the lessons of history. So in that respect, when we look at insurgent Islam and we look at the threat of terrorism, we have to divorce from it any concept of America as God's chosen nation, whether directly or indirectly in the defense of Israel. And instead, we need to make practical decisions and even learn from those that aren't coming from an essentially Christian perspective, like some of our founding fathers, who talked about such things as foreign entanglements and our need to be wise when it comes to our dealings with other nations. I think there are a number of explanations for the insurgency of Islam against the United States. I think that the United States' involvement in geopolitical gamesmanship in the Middle East has spurred on these attacks from terrorists and from Islam, and we need to look long and hard at some of our foreign policy decisions, particularly the billions of dollars that we give to Israel, and particularly the effect that sanctions has had on Iraq and so on over the last 10 years in determining why these nations that are Islamic hate us so much and would want to send terrorists to do harm over here.
Is it true then, because you are poking at one of the most sacred of all sacred cows in American evangelicalism when you talk about aid to Israel, and would you agree that Christians in America to a large degree have confused political and social conservatism with theological orthodoxy, or even equated the two?
Absolutely, I think that, and I think that they do so at the expense of even some of their own, our own Christian brethren over there. There's a great number of Christians in Palestine that we talked about before, some of the Palestinian Lutherans, and there's a large section of Iraq that is Christian, and the Chaldean Christians, and you know, it's as much as we can find fault with Saddam Hussein, and I think that we certainly can, but yet, as totalitarian a picture as we want to paint of him, Christians in areas of Iraq that are majority Christian are able to teach Christianity in public schools, something that hasn't happened in the United States for a long time. They have enjoyed protection to some extent under Saddam Hussein, and in fact, any sort of persecution that they have encountered has come kind of as a result of the United States stepping up pressure against Iraq. And so, you know, things like that need to be factored in to the discussion as well.
Coming back to the issue of Israel, Congressman Tom DeLay made some recent remarks. You talked about politicians being able to employ the language of dispensationalism to effect. And he made some remarks about Israel. Your reaction to that?
He made those remarks. He's made, in fact, a similar speech several times over the last year. And once he did so, last fall, last October, at the Christian Coalition's rally for Israel there in front of the White House. And DeLay made those comments before he was Republican House Majority Leader, but one could make the case that they almost sound treasonous in the sense that he is pledging undying and unwavering support for a foreign state and talking about how anyone that would oppose Israel will be defeated. And underlying that, I think, is not just his ability to use language, but I think DeLay really is a dispensationalist and really does believe that the state of Israel is indestructible because of its place in the end times prophecies that dispensationalists I think, wrongly have deduced.
Not with regard to Israel, but in a far more general sense. Newsweek this last week carried a cover story, Bush and God. Some have accused President George W. Bush in regard to his God talk of trying to shore up an evangelical right base and do precisely what you have concluded Tom DeLay was doing with regard to Israel when it comes to terrorism and Iraq. What do you think, Aaron?
It's difficult to gauge what President Bush's personal beliefs are. When I hear his speeches, I'm always reminded that he doesn't write them, or he writes very little of them. But I do see that there are those in his administration that know how to drop terms and use the shibboleths that evangelicals will connect with and think to themselves, this is our man. I remember back at the State of the Union address when he was talking about faith-based programs, and he said that there's wonder-working power in the hearts and minds of the American people. And you just know that there are Baptists and there are evangelicals sitting there and thinking, he knows that song, There's Power in the Blood, that we sing. He's one of us. And you know, whether he is or not, I don't know, but I know that he knows how to sort of twist the language of evangelicalism to suit his benefit. And of course, the power and the blood that old gospel hymn talks about is not talking about that which is in the hearts and the minds of the American people to mentor and to help young children get off drugs. It's talking about the blood of Jesus Christ. But even in what he said, if I had to just judge his theology based on what he said, I would say he falls more into that post-millennial manifest destiny mentality about America and her role in the world, even though he's able to sort of walk between both worlds. And that's something that Ronald Reagan did very well.
Aaron Wolf, thank you very much. I wish we had more time to talk, but thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
It was my pleasure, Tom.
Aaron Wolf is assistant editor of Chronicles Magazine, published in Rockford, Illinois. He has written this article in a recent edition titled Augustine's City of God. Now, you can read the column on the internet at chroniclesmagazine.org, chroniclesmagazine.org. When we come back, we'll talk with Susan Klein of Missouri Right to Life about a Missouri Senate bill. You probably heard about this on the news, that would let parents sue anyone who enabled a minor daughter to have an abortion without their consent. We'll find out about that after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.